America and all of our listeners all over the world. You're listening to yet another exciting edition of Let's Weekend. I'm your host with the most, Brandon Perkins. Joining me as always is Chris Elogia and Teresa Salmon. Say hi, guys.
Hey.
Hello.
Yeah, it is October 24th, 2020. Yes, we are doing the show again on a Saturday. We promise this is not a regular thing. It's just, it's that time of year and we all got shit to do.
So. Yeah.
But yeah, so we are now officially a little over a week away from the election. Yeah, so like about 8, 9, maybe 10 days away now.
10.
Yep, 10. I don't do math good. And I've been drinking. So I'm doubly screwed. But yeah, and it's yeah, so obviously a bunch of folks have already done their early voting. Teresa, I know you've early voted already.
Yes, and I got confirmation that my vote was counted, so okay. Everything is cool there.
All right. Chris, what about you? Have you voted yet, or are you waiting until November?
Yeah, I voted a week and a half ago.
All right. Well, I guess I'm the only person who's going to be waiting until November to vote then. Yeah, and this is looking to be one of the most involved elections in history. We're looking at, people are estimating that a little over 65% of the American populace will be participating this time, which is a pretty big deal. In a country where voting is a strictly voluntary act and not a required one. And it's mostly because either everyone is voting for Joe Biden or they're voting against Donald Trump. And a small minority is specifically voting to get 4 more years from the current administration.
Well, they may be small, but they sure are vocal.
And they are loud. And rude.
Mm-hmm.
On the one hand, I am very excited. Because, you know, even regardless of who it is that's running, you know, every 4 years we go through this, and it's an exciting time. But also because, well, like I said last week, there's that light at the end of the tunnel and we're getting closer and closer to it. And it feels like, you know, it's, you know, if anything, I'm not just excited, I'm also utterly and completely exhausted. And I think that goes for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Because this has been probably the most stressful 4 years of my entire life. Literally just every other day was just bullshit. And other bullshit piled atop of different kinds of bullshit, all of which is then slathered in a sauce of a different kind of bullshit. Because it was just it's that toxic combination of both cruelty and incompetence, where on the one hand we're just morally outraged, and then at other times we're just like, how the fuck can you screw this up so bad? But yeah, so I really do not expect Donald Trump to be reelected. I do not want anyone to take that as an excuse to not vote, because we absolutely cannot take anything for granted like we did in 2016.
Nope.
We have to actually go out and do it. Also, more than likely, we are not going to find out who won the election on election night. It's going to be one that's going to go on probably for the next couple of days afterwards at the earliest before we end up getting actual results. Because there's going to be all kinds of fuckery going on that night. I can guarantee you that there's going to be mishaps. There's going to be shit getting rerouted. There's going to be, you know, the administration is going to try and pull some last minute lawsuits to stop shit going forward. It's just going to be an absolute clusterfuck. So honestly, my recommendation is if you're voting on November, after you go to your polling place and then come home, just completely disconnect all of your social media for the rest of the day.
Yeah, because nothing good is going to come out of it.
Just don't look at Facebook, don't look at Twitter, or don't even look at Instagram. Just shut it all off for the day. Take a nap. You know, get something to eat. Just play video games. Just do something so you do not have to subject yourself to that shit for the day. Because honestly, you don't deserve it after that.
No, it's a good day to marathon the entire Lord of the Rings trilogy. Extended edition.
Yeah. It's almost here. And I part of me is like, it can't get here soon enough. And the other part of me is, fuck, I just want this to be over.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, on top of all that shit, obviously we got a bunch of our usual shenanigans. We got a bunch of assholes of the week, including one that is just unbelievably morally infuriating in just about every way imaginable. We have some heroes of the week. We've also got a dumbass of the week who managed to, well, I don't know what to call it. I want to call it doing a Pee Wee Herman, but that's a little obscure for this generation. And of course we got a smaller load than usual, from the COVID-19 dump truck, but we also got a shit ton from the election watch. And of course we got some other political shenanigans. There's a bunch of antitrust suits going against Google. The murder hornets are still a thing. We got a bunch of stories from NASA. We also got some entertainment news, including some sequels coming for an old George Lucas project that is not Star Wars related. Because believe it or not, he actually has made other movies than Star Wars projects. Mm-hmm. I know, shocking, right? And we got some Netflix stuff as well. So, before we get to all that, let's start off this bit of shenanigans as we always do. Chris, what have you been doing this week?
I don't know. It seems like we finally broke summer.
Yeah.
At this point, we had 2 days in a row that were almost at 80.
Mm-hmm.
And then it rained and it was in the 40s today.
Yep.
Like we're finally into fall weather.
Mm-hmm.
Which is good. I don't have to worry about it being warm out anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Which is fine. But I did see one of the weirdest Trump trucks I've seen in a while. yeah. It was like a mini parade, I guess. It was one Trump truck with like a big flatbed trailer on the back. Attached to the back that had two other Trump trucks on it that were like old trucks, like old busted down, rusted up trucks.
Mm-hmm.
With their own flags on them, all flags on each of the trucks.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the flags was the American flag, but instead of the red and white stripes, it was ARs, essentially. Like one row of red ones, one row of white. You know, that kind of thing. Just guns all over it. I was like, that doesn't even look good. Besides, like, what point they're trying to make, I guess. It was very ridiculous, and they came into the lot and then out of it in, like, 5 minutes. So it was, like, just in and out. I was like, I don't know what the point was.
Yeah.
This whole thing. Other than just to prove that they can do it.
Yeah, we get shit like that here on occasion, too. Not nearly as much as I thought there would be. And I'll be honest, I have started seeing, there's still plenty of Trump signs everywhere, but a little bit less than you would expect. I have noticed that I've seen some places where Trump signs previously were having been pulled up. And on at least a few occasions, I've seen them replaced with Biden signs. Yeah. So, yeah, it's a good. That's a good sign, I would say. Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see what happens after the election if he loses.
Yeah, I got to tell if that happens, I'm going to have to call my parents. I'm like, yeah, that big flagpole we've got outside with the Trump flag on it, you guys want me to go take that down? Yeah.
Yeah, just tell them.
Want me to go ahead and get
the chainsaw or something and cut it down.
Yeah, you want me to get a razor blade out and take the bumper sticker off the back of mom's car?
Oh, Lord.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, yeah, been watching some stuff on Netflix. Been watching a lot of stuff on Netflix for some reason, but I got around to watching Julie and the Phantoms, which is a show that came out, I think, a few weeks ago. And it was pretty good. It's a musical, kind of drama, comedy kind of thing, a mix of those, where I guess it's based off of a Brazilian show. By basically the same name that that starts with this band, 95, called what were they called? Sunset Curve. And they're practicing at this theater called the Orpheum that and they're about ready to start their show in a little bit, but they're just doing some practice ahead of time. And they're excited. They're ready to go. And three of the four members decide to go get something to eat. And they go get street dogs. Sit down, eat, and then die.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've always suspected that might happen.
Yeah. Let's see. Then it fast forwards to 2020. Where... a girl named Julie, in her house is, a year after her mom died. She's still very much, dealing with that, to the point of she is like needing to actually perform to like audition to get into the music program at her school. I've still been trying to figure out like what kind of school this is, if it's like a big music, school or something like that. It's in LA, so very at least upper middle class, if not like a rich area. One of her former friends is the daughter of like a huge world famous musician.
Yeah.
So it's kind of that kind
It's basically the, what television thinks a normal high school looks like, basically.
Yeah. At least like an LA high school would be. And so she tries to work up the nerve to perform, but doesn't, and sort of gets home, isn't able to do it. And, her dad is kind of thinking maybe the best way to kind of, you know, try to help the kid, help her move on is to move into a new place. So he's like talking about, you know, cleaning up in their garage, which is like a hangout spot, I guess. But it has like her mom's old piano and some other instruments left from the people that owned the house previously, stuff like that. So she goes to like mess with this stuff, and out pops the three band members. They're ghosts. Apparently, it felt like they had been like hanging out in whatever their afterlife was for like an hour, but it had been 25 years in Earth time. She ends up, forming a band with them as they kind of help her kind of get the nerve to, you know, get back into music, get that back into her life, all that kind of stuff. And she's, you know, finds a way to get back into the music program despite like applications being, closed, all that kind of stuff. And they end up performing, a little bit as Julie and the Phantoms. Her little brother is kind of a ghost hunter-esque person who finds out that the ghosts, like her dad was taking pictures of like that garage area, and the three dudes are kind of hanging out there thinking that nothing would come of that. And when he takes out the pictures, there's like these weird orbs where they were at. So like, there's kind of evidence that they exist. The brother kind of thinks that that might be ghosts, cause he's, saw something on YouTube about that, that kind of stuff. But yeah, you learn more about the guys, particularly the main kid, Luke. Because all of them kind of left their homes to do this band thing and not on the best terms. One of the kids is gay, so he was kind of thrown out. They don't touch much on Reggie, who's kind of just the dumb kid. He also looks like a young Benedict Cumberbatch in a weird way. But he's also played off as like being the really stupid guy. Especially kind of just interacting with people like he's an actual person still, and forgetting he's a ghost and that they can't actually communicate with him except for this one girl. There's a bunch of other stuff going on, but it's like 9 episodes, about 30 minutes each, so it's a pretty good binge show. And they perform at least like one number per show. And overall, it's pretty good. Looking forward to season 2. They drop a couple of cliffhangers there, which you're kind of wondering what's going on there, but yeah, it's pretty well done for what it is. Looking forward to more of that, and just been watching a lot of old stuff on Netflix. I watched both of the Ace Ventura movies, which that first one, every time I watch it, I'm always wondering, like, how the fuck was this a movie that kids were allowed to watch?
Yeah.
Because he gets a blowjob so physically demanding that he has to like grab a pole above the doorway just to hang on as like his body is swung around the doorway. but you can still see his pants are on, so you know. Then there's like a vigorous sex scene later on in the movie. And of course, like the last like 15-20 minutes is just full of transphobic shit going on.
What movie is this again?
Ace Ventura.
Oh, right.
Actually, like, oh yeah, they did not know how to handle this. Anyway, as well as there being mental health stuff, they don't handle that well either.
Yeah.
As he tries to fake his way into a mental health facility to sneak in, like, stuff that's kept from former patients, that seems like a weird thing that they would keep.
Yeah.
Anyway, but the second one's where they realize, like, oh yeah, kids like this, so we shouldn't have anything like too obvious. Other than the whole bit with the one girl in the tribe that is supposed to be a virgin that's getting married, and the ending is all, oh, she's not a virgin. He's like, oh, they can tell. And he runs off. That kind of thing. I watched the first two Indiana Jones movies. And I always forget that Indiana Jones is a scumbag. It has who slept with a underage girl.
Yep.
Marion. Which I looked it up, and she was supposed to be, I think, 15 when they first started dating.
Yeah.
She was 25. So I guess that's emblematic of that era. That's
The thing you're supposed to kind of remember about Indiana Jones is he's not necessarily a virtuous hero. He's more of an anti-hero.
Yeah.
Like, the dude is a treasure hunter. And the thing about treasure hunters is that they are fairly morally complicated by design.
Yeah,
I mean, there's a reason why Nathan Drake is sometimes kind of an asshole.
Yeah, but he doesn't engage in anything really too nasty. But yeah, like the first movie, Belloc is basically kind of like they're just the same guy, but Indiana Jones just doesn't want to admit it, I guess. Then he goes on like a weird Joker thing where he's like, oh, if just one thing happens, you could easily become me and do the scrupulous things I've done kind of thing.
Well, the big difference is that Belloc allies himself with the Nazis. That's sort of the big difference.
He's willing to do whatever it takes. And that means working with the Nazis and getting his he doesn't get melted, he gets exploded, I guess.
Yeah, his head goes kaboom.
Seeing the effects was pretty cool, the way they a lot of them still hold up. You can tell when they're doing like green screen stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Same with the second movie. There's like, oh, this looks pretty good, and this I was like, oh, I can see the green screen thing. Like when they fall out of the plane with the inflated boat. Like when they land and they're like constantly switching between, oh, here's the close up mm-hmm. of the actors in the raft. Then it zooms out to where it's obviously either dolls or trained professionals
mm-hmm.
kind of thing. That kind of stuff. What else? I watched War Games.
Oh, yeah.
Which still holds up pretty well.
Yeah, shockingly well. Even though it's like everything from like the technology to the fucking like, you know, elite hacker speaking shit is obviously very dated. The overall message is still very clear.
Yeah. It's kind of dated, but it works for what the tech was at that time.
Yeah, it still resonates really well.
Yeah. The notion of using the phone line to call other computers
mm-hmm.
kind of thing was very much a thing.
I mean, the Usenet was a thing back then. So
yeah.
But yeah.
Where you set up like a bot to call all the numbers in
yep.
Santa Monica to try to find the video game company.
Yep, that was a thing too. Those also yeah. existed back then. Bots, worms, those were all a thing.
They just didn't have the sophisticated tech now to be like, oh, where is that coming from?
Yeah, it's not funny so because, you know, like I said, the movie originally came out in 1983. So, yeah, I mean, the internet did not exist the way we think of it did, but things like Usenet were a thing. And, you know, like hacker communities like this, yes, they did exist. They were mostly, you know, mostly relegated to like MIT and stuff. But, yeah. And even though, you know, all the tech and stuff and the fashion obviously is really dated, the overall theme and story somehow manages to be timeless somehow.
Yeah. Yeah, even him being like a dork, a nerd who likes games mm-hmm. and all that, they don't play off of the same kind of stereotypes other movies would.
Mm-hmm.
He's known as like that weird guy that has a computer. Like even they do in like Ferris Bueller.
Mm-hmm.
Where he's mm-hmm. like knows how to use it, but sort of like, well, I'm not a nerd to use this, know how to use this stuff.
Mm.
I'm not your nerd.
Well, this was also the era when like home computers were slowly making their way into the average household. So yeah. The idea of the family having a computer wasn't necessarily a nerdy thing necessarily anymore. No. But, you know, but it was a cultural shift. Yeah.
Yeah. It's very much a thing that your kid had
mm-hmm.
to help with, like, school stuff.
Yeah.
And he just knew how to exploit it
mm-hmm.
for his own gain to, you know, change his grades and all that.
Yep.
And, yeah, I do love the joke where teacher's talking about, you know, asexual reproduction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who was the first to come up with that idea? And he's like, your wife. It's like that's a good joke,
mm-hmm.
Smart ass joke.
Mm-hmm.
I guess is a setup to get him to the principal's office so he can
mm-hmm.
sneak what the password is because he knows they change it. Change mm-hmm. like pencil. That's a good password. Your password is what you see.
Yep.
Yeah. Not good password security, but
mm-hmm.
that's what the 80s were. That's largely it for the Netflix stuff. I do need to get back and finish up The Mandalorian now that mm-hmm. season 2 is starting here next week.
Yep.
As for game stuff, I've been playing more Rocket League, kind of getting back to actually winning, but not back into the platinum ranking yet. Still running into dum-dums getting on my team, that kind of stuff. But they're doing a Halloween event.
Mm-hmm.
With special items to get that are all Ghostbusters related. I think Fortnite just showed their event and it's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Ghostbusters outfits and such for your characters. I think the Rocket League one's a bit better because you get I got the like banner thing for my name tag. That is the ooze. The ghost mm-hmm. ooze. kind of thing. So yeah, that's it's a good time. Playing some Fallout 76 on PC on Game Pass, and that's been a not great experience because of the Game Pass stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I downloaded the game a while back. It's like 86 gigs, something like that. I noticed whenever it's had updates, it just wants you to download a file that is 86 gigs again, which is not great. But the most recent one seemed to break the game, so it wouldn't load anymore when I tried to start it on Game Pass. So I had to delete it and then download 86 gigs again of the game so it actually works. Mm-hmm. Ended up starting a fresh save there because I couldn't bring my one over from Xbox One.
Mm-hmm.
For that, for some reason, and it's one of those PC games that doesn't let you mess with the graphics settings and just keep playing.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, you got to restart. Like, oh, that shouldn't be a thing anymore. You should be able to just make the changes and move on. But I guess that's the Bethesda part of their whole thing, because that's very much a part of the other Fallout games on PC.
Mm-hmm.
And Elder Scrolls, where they have like specific launchers on the Steam stuff I have. You have to do all your settings there and then launch the game. Because God forbid you do it in the game and it just says, okay, let's move on.
Mm-hmm.
So it feels like every time I want to mess with that, I don't want to play it to double check how good that is.
Mm-hmm.
If it's better. So it's not running super great, but I think it's because I have some settings on a little too high. But started playing the beginning with a fresh character, so I could see like what the new story stuff and all that, how that works out, and it works out pretty well. It was just weird getting out of the vaults and being like, oh, I have no weapons, just running up and punching these robots that around the entrance to the vault that you have to take out. These like Chinese robots, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Especially these little things shooting lasers at you. Got to the big early place that you get to for your first like big story mission, and did some exploring and all that. Built my base on top of a cliff, I guess. It's not really a big one, so I can just fall off and not die, but it was just like a place where I could build it and it wouldn't be too easily accessible if I want to hang out there for a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's, but I went and came back, to play some more later. And the weird thing is somebody else had built theirs there on that server. Mm-hmm. So I was like, oh, you want to move this for free? You want to start a new server? And I was like, I don't know. I ended up just quitting back out and starting up again.
Mm-hmm.
And, got onto a server where nobody else had done that. So that's kind of where I am at for the most part, just kind of exploring, grabbing stuff. And the way they handle like junk is a bit different, where you're able to collect all that stuff, but that's, you know, it's all for the crafting and all that, upgrading your weapons and armor and all that. And it takes up a lot more weight, so it's best to kind of, when you get to a crafting station, it's just break it all down into the core components, because it's a lot lighter than the rest of it. So that kind of lets me get more room to pick up useless shit.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot less of it than the regular Fallout games, which makes sense for the most part. I just kind of wish it would have more ways to manage that stuff, because it's still kind of the same Fallout interface. So yeah, like I have multiples of weapons, but unlike Fallout 3, where you kind of combine weapons to repair them, so you conveniently lose some weight, but make your guns better, you kind of just have to go back to a crafting station and find go to do the repairs on that way.
Mm-hmm.
But also kind of the way they do perks is not great, because you don't really set out your special attributes up front. It's usually start at one. As you level up, you get to add a point to that, and then that allows you to equip these cards that you get
mm-hmm.
that are the perks. But it's not like you get a list of stuff like in 3, or you get like a tree of sorts in 4. You just kind of open up these packs on occasion of cards, and that dictates what sort of upgrades you can get. So sometimes you get stuff that's like, oh, this isn't very enticing. It's mostly like trying to minimize the thirst and hunger meters that are part of that game, which don't really affect it too much, but occasionally you have to stop and eat or drink stuff, even though if you don't really need it for your health-wise, which is why you want to make soups, because they can... It is like 10% of one and 15% of the other. So you kind of take both, care of both with one thing. And I mean, it also lightens up your inventory, all that kind of stuff. So it's like, it's an okay place right now. Seems like they're still adding more content, and I'm still in the early game stuff, so I'm not really at the point to see like what all the new stuff is in that. But I believe they're supposed to be adding the Brotherhood of Steel at some point here. So they're just kind of adding more to that game for the time being. But also playing Time Spinner, playing some more of that. I got the double jump. So now I can really get around. So I'm just like trying to figure out like what places I haven't been able to go to because I couldn't do any sort of double jump and figure that stuff out. But I'm kind of just over-leveled for where I'm at. So I'm not really caring much about getting hit. Outside of boss fights. That's like the only point where I get threatened, but I have enough health items that I can refill up and not really be too inconvenienced. Especially because I got one of my items just does fire damage. And so they just keep burning and losing damage over time for a bit. So I'm just continually hitting them just to keep that going. And that just kind of makes all the fights and boss fights easier. That's kind of where I'm at with that, and that's been pretty much it. How about you, Teresa?
I've been just playing forever games, you know, things that I'm always playing. A little bit of Civ 6. Bloons TD 6 was playing that, which is still just a rock solid game. So, I mean, it's just amazing. And then Kingdom 2 Crowns. I've been playing that. Been watching a lot of TV, but like, what have I been watching? I don't know if I could tell you what I've been watching. Honestly, I don't think I could tell you. It's just so, you know, everything. Star Trek Discovery, Star Trek Lower Decks finished up actually. And then we also watched Borat, the movie, last night. Although I really didn't follow it very well because there's other stuff going on.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was, it seemed interesting. I don't know what it seemed. It seemed something. So
this is the original or the sequel?
No, the sequel. I've got to rewatch that because my head wasn't in it last night.
Was the Giuliani scene as bad as,
they could not have let that gone on 1 second longer. Like, it couldn't have gone 1 second longer because it could have gotten incriminating or it could have not been. He gave him an out, which, you know, is probably by design.
Yeah.
I don't know, man. I don't know. There was nothing good about it. I can tell you that much. But, I could see that maybe he was just adjusting, but I don't think he was just adjusting.
Yeah.
I don't know. It was just, why would they even go into a bedroom? So much of it just didn't make sense. So I don't know.
Yeah. All right. Anything else?
No, not really.
Nope. Okay.
That was really about it.
All right. Well, as for me, I am just about done with Trails in the Sky second chapter. I'm literally on the last boss fight now. Only thing is, it's a really, really difficult boss fight, so I'm going back and grinding a little bit to, you know, get my experience up. Yeah. The last part, like the last chapter of that game is very, it's difficult. Basically, you're the whole, you know, the whole party has basically are in the royal airship, and it crash lands onto this this flying city called the Liber Ark, which is apparently must have been like the some kind of remnant of like the ancient civilization that existed before the foundation of the liberal kingdom and all that. And it's got like several sections you have to go through, all of which have are connected via like a rail network. And then after that, you then have to go into the final dungeon, which itself has multiple floors, and has some enemies that can be real assholes. There's this one particular enemy that will basically every attack it does, it will either both attacks it does, it'll give you like a some sort of awful like it'll give you some awful effect. It might put you to sleep, it'll give you silence so you can't use magic, or it'll petrify you, and it'll either do that and also heal damage, or it'll explode and basically hit everyone in your party with like over 1,000 damage. So it's,
oh jeez,
yeah. And on top of that, you are now going through all the other enforcers from Ouroboros, other four before you end up getting to the last boss. So you have four epic boss fights you have to go through until you get to the final guy. Yeah, it's difficult, but it's Trails, so it's worth it, and it's still a lot of fun. You know, for those who don't know, Cold Steel 4 comes out next week. So yeah. excited for that as well. So I'm wanting to finish this before I get to that. I recently decided to experiment with a little bit of gaming outside of my range. So I decided to start playing Kaiserreich. Have you guys ever tried playing Kaiserreich before? Lou?
No.
No? Okay. Do you guys know what Hearts of Iron is?
No.
It's like one of those like old school grand strategy games that's like really deep and complex, and like you don't have to just worry about like military shit, but also like political and resources and crap like that.
One of those like Eastern European ass games.
Yeah, kind of. Okay. Basically, Kaiserreich was originally like a mod to Hearts of Iron. I think it was Hearts of Iron 4. That then sort of took on a life of its own and became like its own thing. Basically, the whole sort of conceit of Kaiserreich is the idea that the Central Powers end up winning World War I instead of the Allies. Which, for those of you who don't remember, World War I, you had the Allied nations. That was Britain. That was the United Kingdom and all its territories. France, Russia. And later on, you had the United States and versus the Central Powers, which was Germany, Austro-Hungary. I think Italy was also in there as well. And the idea is, what would happen if instead of the Allies winning, the Central Powers, which was largely dominated by the German Empire, they end up winning? And basically, it ends up throwing all of the world into chaos. Amongst other things, the Bolshevik Revolution gets crushed in Russia. Lenin is assassinated by Fela Kaplan, who, for those who don't know, in real life, Fela Kaplan actually did try to assassinate Lenin, and it's the one that eventually inspired him to found the Cheka secret police and start the Red Terror, all that stuff. And what ends up happening is that communism still comes into existence, but it comes in under the form of syndicalism, and it ends up rising in Great Britain and France. So you have the what's known as the Union of Britain and the combined French syndicates, who end up sort of becoming the big red menace in this new world. Of course, the German Empire still exists. Kaiser Wilhelm II is still the head, still the emperor. They end up seizing a bunch of territories. The United States is basically broken after the Great Depression hits and ends up descending into its own civil war. Once again, in yet another alternate history scenario, Douglas MacArthur stages a military coup. I don't know, for some reason, in just a shit ton of alternate history scenarios, Douglas MacArthur ends up becoming like a military dictator or leading like a military junta or something. Like that's the same for like Reds, the Revolutionary Timeline, which is a project I get involved with sometimes. Only in that one, he ends up basically fleeing with his counter-revolutionary forces and setting up a exile government in Cuba. But yeah, it's like, it's really neat on the one hand, but it also kind of plays fast and loose with some historical personalities that I honestly am not entirely sure I would consider it accurate or reasonable or logical in some ways. Like, for example, like I mentioned the Union of Britain earlier, in the Union of Britain, there's a couple of new political factions that ends up coming into existence, and one of them is called Totalism, which is essentially like this timeline sort of version of kind of like a basically the idea of like making horseshoe theory a real thing, where you have like this hardcore authoritarian version of socialism that also tends to have like a tinges of nationalism in it, and it ends up getting inspired by Oswald Mosley. And I don't know if any of you guys know who Oswald Mosley was, but he was the guy in our timeline as the head of the British Union of Fascists. But the thing about the totalist ideology, especially in Britain, is that its inherents include both George Orwell and Clive Staples Lewis. Also, usual reading. Been reading some more obscure stuff. I don't really know what to make of it yet. I'll probably talk about it more next week. And also, just because I, you know, have been kind of on a riff tracks kick lately, I decided to watch some old cheesy 80s action movies. One of the movies I watched was a movie called Stone Cold. I don't know if any of you guys have ever seen this. It's a really fucking stupid, like, cheesy action movies. Barry Bostwick is like the lead actor, and he plays like this undercover cop who goes undercover in like a biker gang, and it's got a bunch of like really gratuitous nudity and violence that makes no goddamn sense. Crass and cheesy. I just love it. But
Barry Bostwick, man, I haven't heard about him in ages.
He was in.
He's been around. He's one of those dudes that just kind of disappeared into the background, but he was a big deal for a little while.
Yeah.
Wasn't he in Rocky Horror Picture Show?
Yeah, I think he was. He played Janet's boyfriend.
Yeah. Which is wild to think about.
Yeah.
It's like him and Susan Sarandon.
Yeah. Mm. Okay. So yeah, anything to add before we move on?
I guess I'll mention that I am doing a PS2 anniversary stream tomorrow.
Yeah,
1 p.m.
I heard about that.
Because it is, Monday is the 20th anniversary of the PS2 here in North America. And that is a landmark console for the industry.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll be playing a bunch of stuff and talking about the PS2. Kind of celebrating the wide breadth of its library. That's pretty much it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, pay attention to that. All right. So without further ado, I guess it's now time to move on to everybody's favorite part of the show, Brandon's Random Factoid. And one of the things that I like to talk about on this particular segment is the idea that the past was not always as primitive as we always seem to imagine it was. I talked several shows ago about the sort of misconception we have of the sort of pastoral view of the Middle Ages, where it was all, you know, knights with swords and shields and spears, and like the most technologically advanced it may get is like with a catapult or a trebuchet. You know what I'm talking about, right? Right.
Yeah.
But as I mentioned back then, the truth of the matter is that, you know, powder weapons and like firearms were already a thing being fairly used fairly often by the time the Middle Ages came around. Granted, they weren't necessarily very advanced or accurate for the most part, but they were used fairly often, especially as siege weaponry. Cannons in particular were being used as far back as the 1200s. And if you ever like look at like old medieval manuscripts, like illuminated manuscripts, and you go through them, you'll start to see the use of like cannons and rifles and stuff in a lot of those illustrations. Not always, but you will find them there. Usually they'll be in like the guise of like religious allegories where it's like the forces of hell are using guns, because back then the church kind of associated firearms with the demonic, you know. But there was another way that the past was not as primitive as we think in the form of warfare. Let me ask you guys, when you guys were like back in high school and you were studying history, did your history teacher ever come about and mention something called Greek fire?
No.
Heard of it in books and whatnot, but no, okay. not at school.
Okay. So for those of you who don't know what Greek fire is, Greek fire was, first of all, it wasn't invented by the ancient Greeks. So, you know, Rick Riordan is full of shit. It was no one has ever been able to quite figure out what the exact formula was. But basically what Greek fire was, is it was essentially a sort of Byzantine form of napalm. It was a very sticky, viscous, and very flammable substance that would continue, that would not only stick to something, but would also continue to burn. And most often than not, this stuff was often used as in naval warfare more than anything else, because it was absolutely perfect for it. Usually it would be used, especially if you go back and look at like ancient manuscripts, once again, when they use this stuff, you will see them, usually they'll use it in a couple of different ways. One very common image you'll see is just someone literally looking like they're tossing it out of like a vase or a pot or whatever, which apparently was something that they would do. Basically, they would have like a big old vase of this stuff, and then they would light the top of it on fire, and then someone would pick up the vase and just slosh it over onto the enemy ship, where it would then stick to the ship and then quickly catch fire. It was also not unusual to see them basically fill up what they called fire pots, which were basically just like Byzantine versions of like fire bombs, where they would like have little handheld like pots that they would then light the top on fire that had the stuff in it, and they would just throw it at the enemy ship. And once again, it would shatter, it would spread the stuff around, the ship would quickly catch fire. On some occasions, they also fastened a siphon that would either – it would either be like at the fore of the ship, or it would be like sort of like at the side of the ship where like you would imagine like cannons or crossbows or something would be put. And they would literally, using like air pressure, Basically, they would act like medieval flamethrowers, literally. Yeah, it would just, you know, just set off like a steady stream of the stuff, and it would just light the shit on fire. And the best thing about this stuff is it would continue to burn even if it was like sitting on top of the water, because it basically was an oily substance. And much like, you know, gasoline or whatever, it would just continue to burn on top of the water. Now, of course, I should also mention that Byzantine battleships were largely made of wood. Yeah, so...
yep.
That meant that there was another hazard when using this stuff. So it had to be used very,
delicately?
Delicately, very carefully. But here's something I did not know until, and I literally only learned it this week. Greek fire wasn't just used in naval warfare. It was also used in siege warfare as well. They would also, like, if they were going against, like, castles or fortresses or something like that, they would also use it as a siege weapon. And by that, that would mean that they could, like, fire it over a wall, or, like, they could make, like, a big pot of this stuff, and they could either, like, either defending a castle or, like, going up against the castle, they could put, like, a big burning pot of this stuff and just turn it over. If you've ever seen, like, old movies where, like, an angry mob is attacking a castle and, like, one of the castle guards, like, dumps a big pot of this stuff, it's kind of like that. But, do you know what else they also had? Fucking handheld flamethrowers. No joke.
Wow.
Yes. I put a picture in the chat here. But those of you who are wanting to see what it is, it's on the Wikipedia page for Greek fire. It's a old Byzantium manuscript. The thing that he is using is called a chirosiphon, or a hand siphon. And the guy is literally standing on top of what they used to call a flying bridge, which was like it was basically just a siege weapon that was basically, it was a siege machine that was literally just like a giant platform on top of a huge ladder. And yeah, it's literally handheld. He's holding it by the handle by his left hand, and there's a knob or some sort of a rotating mechanic where he's literally like siphoning out this stuff. There's nobody on like the battlement where he's firing this thing at, but it's pretty obvious what it's supposed to do. This was like from a this is from like I think around this is like the, yeah this was Byzantium. This is like from the 10th century. So this is like the 900s. We haven't even gotten into the millennium yet. Yeah. And now it needs to be pointed out what you're seeing as far as like on that picture is a estimation on what it might have looked like according to, you know, the person who's, you know, illustrating that particular manuscript. But there's been like other ideas of like what the chirosiphon looked like. There have been estimates where it may have actually looked very similar to like what a modern day flamethrower looks like. There are reconstructions of what these chirosiphons could have looked like that you'll find on like Reddit. And for all intents and purposes, yeah, it looks like a modern day flamethrower. Essentially there's like a huge, like a wick on the end of like this huge, like bell shaped siphon connected to like a huge tube that contains the substance inside of it. There's like a metal plate on top that sort of helps direct it and sort of focus it forward. Yeah, it looks exactly like what you would imagine a modern flamethrower looks like. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it kind of is.
There are like more fanciful ones that make it look a bit more advanced than it probably was. Then again, it could have looked more advanced than that. We don't know. This is purely speculation. We know they existed because they're chronicled in various manuscripts and stuff, but yeah, this shit totally was a real thing. And it's like one of those reminders that, you know, the Middle Ages were not, and, you know, earlier, were not the sort of storybook pastoral ideal that we had. No, they fucking used firearms and shit back then, too. And, yeah. So, that has been yet another installment of Brandon's Rant of Factoid. Byzantines were pretty fucking hardcore. Yeah.
Kind of were.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So, with that, it's now time to move on to the show proper. And as always, we have to start off with our assholes of the week. Our king assholes of the week this week. And frankly, this will just make them the king asshole, probably of all time. One of the greatest crimes against humanity that the Trump administration is responsible for is the policy of separating children from their parents at the border.
Yeah.
Now, you've probably heard people trying to say, well, yeah, but, you know, who built the cages? You know, who started the practice? The Obama administration has its own problems with this issue. They call them deporter-in-chief for a reason. But they didn't do shit like this.
No.
No. This week, lawyers reported that they cannot find the parents of some 545 children that were separated by the Trump administration.
Yep.
There's all sorts of bullshit reasons why.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of them are because their parents were deported without them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And some of it's just such pure bureaucracy, they don't even know who they belong to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, about two-thirds of those parents were deported to Central America without their children.
Yep. And now even, we can't...
Even being pulled apart from their parents for a little bit of time is still... extremely detrimental, much less, you know, weeks or months.
Yeah.
Cases years
at some of these points.
Yeah. It's going to take decades to sort this out.
Well,
and I'm serious about that. Decades.
I keep saying these kids are going to grow up, they're going to be completely and utterly broken, and they're going to shoot the place down.
Yeah. And I want people to know something. We largely believe that Stephen Miller is the primary architect of this. Don't get me wrong. He did play a huge part in it. But the guy who was the chief architect of this particular policy was not Stephen Miller, even though he totally would have totally signed off on it.
Yeah.
The actual architect of this is primarily Jeff Sessions.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
So for the rest of his wretched life, do not ever let that man forget that he is responsible for this. That this man is responsible for destroying the childhood of over 545 young people. That he has a direct responsibility in committing this atrocity. If we're lucky, that old fucker's going to get his ass dragged to The Hague after all of this is over.
Certainly hope so. No, that's I think what a lot needs to happen.
A lot of fucking assholes in the Trump administration have to get their asses dragged there. Yeah. And I'm hoping the Biden administration will actually go through with that.
Yeah. Empower the new AG to set up the groups or whatever to investigate this stuff.
I need a fucking Truth and Reconciliation Committee after all of this is over.
People to sort through all the bullshit.
Yeah. And I don't know if anybody know what, like, a Truth and Reconciliation Committee is. That's the shit that's set up after, like, a civil war is over. Or, like, there's a, you know, like, a really brutal dictator has been dethroned and the new government has taken power. That's the degree of the type of shit we're talking about here. Because, let's be honest, this is all awful. The reality is probably much worse than we think it is, than we know it is right now.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
But of course, the parade of terrible doesn't end there. Just anybody who wants to know, next week's show is going to be the last show we have before the election. And let's just say before we sign off, I'm going to have some things to say about all of this. So, you know, stay tuned. But before all that, of course, we still got this week's show. And we got another bit of assholes. It's Purdue Pharmaceuticals. You guys know who Purdue Pharmaceuticals are, right?
Yeah, makers of OxyContin.
The people who inflicted OxyContin onto the American people. They are basically single-handedly responsible for the opioid crisis in the United States. Now, granted, they had people who helped them, including a bunch of very corrupt doctors who kept handing the shit out like it was Halloween candy. But they were the people who made it. They were the ones who promoted it. They were the ones who kept telling people that it was not addictive. And that people who did get addicted to it were social misfits who needed to be treated harshly.
Oh. Yep.
And this week, they are going to be pleading guilty to 3 federal charges.
Yeah, it's part of a settlement of more than $8 billion that the Justice Department announced.
Mm-hmm.
Does not release any of the company's executives or owners, members of the wealthy Sackler family, from criminal liability. Mm-hmm. A criminal investigation is ongoing. Family members said they acted, quote, ethically and lawfully. Some state attorneys general said the agreement fails to hold the Sacklers accountable.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they'll get their day, hopefully.
They will, eventually.
The company will plead guilty to 3 counts, including conspiracy to defraud the United States and violating federal anti-kickback laws.
Mm-hmm.
Officials said an agreement will be detailed in the bankruptcy court filing in federal court. The Sacklers will lose all control over their company. We've already in the works. Purdue will become a public benefit company, meaning will be governed by a trust that has to balance the trust interests against those of the American public and public health.
Mm-hmm.
The settlement is the highest profile display yet of the federal government seeking to hold a major drug maker responsible for an opioid addiction and overdose crisis, mm-hmm. linked to more than 470,000 deaths in this country since 2000.
Mm-hmm.
Which we're nearly at halfway to that in just over 7 deaths. Months for COVID deaths.
Yep.
This is just 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Next up, we got some assholes from Texas. Because, of course, first, there's a new rule in Texas that is allowing social workers to turn away LGBTQ or disabled clients.
That's just...
You know, the first part of that is awful, but the disabled part just makes it extra awful.
Yeah.
Yeah, Texas social workers criticizing the state regulatory board's decision this week to remove protections for LGBTQ clients and clients with disabilities seek social work services. They voted unanimously Monday to change a section of its code of conduct. Establishes when a social worker may refuse to serve somebody. COVID no longer prohibits social workers from turning away clients on the basis of disability, sexual orientation, or gender identity. Governor Greg Abbott's office recommended this change because the code's non-discrimination protections went beyond protections laid out in the state law that governs how and when the state may discipline social workers.
Yeah.
Which, if that's the case, then those laws are also bad.
Yeah. Here's the thing. With Greg Abbott, I can at least understand why he decided to put the LGBTQ thing, because he's a homophobic scumbag. We all know that. But why the disabled thing?
Yeah, right?
Yeah,
like, is he going from, like, evangelical to just full-on Nazi? And it's like, he's saying, you know, the disabled need to be allowed to die or something. Like, what's the point there?
Yeah, I don't know. Let's see, the executive director of the Texas chapter of the National Association of Social Workers called this change incredibly disheartening. Stephen Parks, a social worker in private practice in Houston, works with child trauma victims, told them that the rule change was both a professional and personal gut punch. There's now a gray area between what's legally allowed and ethically responsible. He said the law should never allow a social worker to legally do unethical things, which I'm guessing is turning away clients that need help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I'm still trying to wrap my head around that last part. Just it seems weirdly out of the blue because I want, for whatever reason, I don't want to think that a person will sink to that level.
Clearly they do.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of more Texas fuckery, the Attorney General of Texas has fired two of the aides that reported him for bribery.
Yeah, we talked about this a couple weeks ago, I think.
Yeah.
Where his, about seven of his aides had reported him for various offenses, including bribery, and he has fired two of them so far, I think. Seeming to clearly go against laws around retaliation against whistleblowers.
Mm-hmm.
Local and national ones.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's he's fired, let's see here, Blake Brickman was fired on Tuesday. Lacey Mays was also fired Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Blake was the Deputy Attorney General for Policy and Strategy Initiatives.
Mm-hmm.
Lacey Mays was Deputy Attorney General for Administration. Lacey said it was not voluntary on her departure from the office, but declined to comment further. I assume it was just add to the investigation.
Mm.
Yeah, they talked to a North Texas employment attorney who said the situation looks like what the Texas Whistleblower Act was designed to prevent. Mm-hmm. Timing looks bad.
Yep.
Having done this just after he was reported for various violations of his office.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's something rotten in Texas. Just absolutely.
Yep.
But it's not all bad because we do have some heroes of the week. First and foremost, we have the young 14-year-old Anika Chabrolu. From Frisco, Texas. She was a participated in the 3M Young Science Challenge, which is a challenge for young people who want to get into the sciences, and you can get prizes out of it. But this particular young lady, she got $25,000 because she made a discovery that will lead to potential therapy for COVID-19.
Oh, really?
Yes. She invented a contraption that uses in silico methodology to discover a lead molecule that can selectively bind to the spike protein of the SARS-CoV-2 virus.
That's pretty hardcore.
Yeah. Again, 14 years old. And she's Indian American. Her parents, I believe, are immigrants.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. That's about it.
that's pretty excellent, though.
Yeah.
Very
that
impressive.
That is awesome. Mm-hmm. Hope the Mayo Clinic or someone's got her number on speed dial, because she's going to go on to do some great things, I bet.
Certainly.
Yeah, I imagine there'll be colleges lined up to get her
scholarship
as soon as she's ready.
Mm-hmm. And plus, $25,000 ain't too shabby, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And another great one, mostly because I both just love, well, you'll see. Over in San Francisco, the officials there voted to pass a law known as the Caution Against Racially and Exploitive Non-Emergencies, or the Karen Act, that makes racially motivated phone calls to 911 illegal.
Yep.
Yes, it is literally called the Karen Act.
Yeah, introduced in July after several high-profile incidents, including a couple calling the police on a man writing Black Lives Matter in chalk in front of his own home in Pacific Heights. Name is clear. Nod to the online moniker Karen. Mm-hmm. Described the behavior of a middle-aged white woman acting entitled or demanding. Yeah, expand the definition of a protected class in San Francisco to prevent false emergency calls with the specific intent to discriminate against a person or otherwise infringe the person's rights, cause the person specified harms on the basis of the person's race, color, ancestry, national origin, place of birth, sex, age, religion, creed, disability, sexual orientation, gender identity, weight or height.
Mm-hmm.
The act would accommodate a civil cause of action for the victim of discrimination to cover damages of at least $1,000 in damages plus attorney fees, which is something that needs to be more of a national law.
Yeah.
Because 9/11 has to deal with enough crap.
Mm-hmm.
And lack of funding and all that kind of stuff, which has to be used for petty bullshit like this.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, I do love that they got the Karen in there as well. That's just special.
Icing. Pure, sweet icing on the cake.
Yeah. And now, for our dumbass of the week. Our dumbass of the week is CNN anchor and reporter for The New Yorker, Jeffrey Toobin. He was suspended from both this week after he accidentally was caught on a Zoom call masturbating in an election meeting for The New Yorker when he thought he was muted.
Yeah. It's one of the things you gotta have, you gotta know the boundaries, you gotta know how to turn it off or put something over if you're gonna fucking do that during a work call.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I made an embarrassingly stupid mistake, believing I was off camera. I apologize to my wife, family, friends, and coworkers. I thought I had muted the Zoom video. I thought no one on the Zoom call could see me. So far, I declined to confirm details, but I believe he was in some sort of like election coverage meeting for the election coming up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think they had different people like talking about the, you know, workshopping things like, oh, you're the Democrats, you're Republicans, you know, all this kind of stuff. And he was just seen doing some shit that was very questionable.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously got reported and suspended for I don't know how long. But obviously missing, you know, point in time where he's most valuable to both organizations.
Mm-hmm.
And CNN didn't necessarily suspend him, but he is taking personal leave time.
Yep.
I assume to deal with the fallout of all this shit.
Mm-hmm.
So, dude, you gotta have better awareness than this.
Yeah.
Especially when you're on camera at the same time.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, anyway, so moved on from there. We're going to start with the proper show proper. And as we always must do, open up the garage and back up the COVID-19 dump truck because we got a small load this week, but a load nonetheless. First and foremost, as always, we have to start with the numbers. Worldwide, there are now 42.5 million cases that have been identified with about 1.1 million deaths registered. In the United States alone, there are about 8.6 million cases and about 224,800 deaths.
Yeah. India's getting pretty close. They're about 700,000 cases behind us.
Mm-hmm.
This is a bit further behind. It's about 70,000.
Yeah. Well, as we warned everybody, this shit was going to start ramping back up once fall and winter got here. And here it is.
Yeah, when you got other health shit going on at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Try to warn people, look, it's going to get bad once winter gets here.
Yeah, and the carelessness from the summer.
Mm-hmm.
It's come back to haunt many places. And this is the worst time for it to happen because, you know, Trump's essentially running on his handling of this shit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And this is a big F on his record.
Yep.
You know, he was on Twitter earlier today complaining that the media is covering the amount of cases we have. Just like, I think I saw somebody's basically saying, you know, I hope he fucking loses because if not, then this is never going to end. The epidemic is never going to end.
Because
you have this kind of child dealing with things.
Yeah. Yeah. So this week, coming up this week, Mitch McConnell is planning to vote for a pretty skinny relief bill.
Yeah, it's just a $300 billion Senate Republican coronavirus relief bill, far below the $2 trillion one that Democrats have been campaigning for.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. It would follow a standalone vote on additional paycheck protection program funds.
Mm-hmm.
For that stuff. I think that's the gist of the bill.
Mm-hmm.
And estimated $257 billion for the the Triple P program.
Yeah. And last bit of news we got for it for COVID tonight. A bunch of different companies are trying vaccine trials and everything. And AstraZeneca recently continued their trial after one of their volunteers recently passed away. Thing is, the guy that died was part of the placebo group.
Yeah.
So
they don't think it was related to the vaccine at all.
Yeah. Those you don't know, when they're doing like vaccine and medicinal trials, they'll usually give a placebo to some of the test subjects as sort of a control.
Yep.
And this guy happened to be one of them.
Yep.
Which is sad, but, you know, they were a volunteer. They knew it was a possibility.
Yep.
And I mean, even if he wasn't taking anything, it's still kind of like, wow.
Yeah. Put the truck back into the garage. Be back next week when we'll bring it back out again, because we inevitably will. We will. Anyway, now moving on to pretty much the main event, which is 2020 U.S. Election Watch. So, we are, like I said at the top of the show, we are now about 10 days away until the election. And we have had a surge of early and mail-in voting this time. And over 51 million people have voted already, which is setting records all over the country. Here in Georgia, that rate is up about 140% from what it was in 2016.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it looks like Georgia right now is at 2.5 million for early voted. Not sure how that compares to 2016, at least on this first one, which is the U.S. Elections Project, which has a really nice chart and all that, let you see like how it's going. They've got, as of today, 57 million. Early votes, almost 40 that are mail-in, about 18 that are in-person.
Yep.
Actually, I looked at Ohio. There's definitely a couple of weird little issues, like some counties that are not reporting anything.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's policy sort of thing or what, but that's a bit weird.
Mm.
And one of them is mine, so I don't know what. that looks like, but yeah, it's a lot of states and areas are reporting early voting numbers that are way higher than what they were in 2016. Some that are like, you know, several times higher than what it was before, which makes sense because we got a pandemic going on. People want to get in early and not deal with the election day crowd. That kind of stuff. But yeah, it's, and we're possibly on track to have the highest turnout of eligible voters since 1908. That year, Republican Taft defeated Democrat challenger Bryan, William Jennings Bryan, with 67% of voting eligible population participating.
Mm-hmm.
That's before the 19th Amendment, so that did not include women.
Yeah.
Or many Black Americans.
Right.
Greater than 80% of eligible voters in some years would vote in the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
Because they picked Tuesday because it was, it gave people time to travel to the voting locations.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have to work every day.
Right.
Like we do now.
Uh-huh.
Well, it doesn't take us, you know, a day or more to travel. Still, it would be nice to have a day off. Some businesses do it, but
Some others do not.
Yeah.
For some of them, that's by design.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Because of a split vote that happened in the Supreme Court this week, Pennsylvania will be allowed to count ballots received by November 6th.
Yep. Yeah, what was it? John Roberts sided with the liberals on this, so it split the votes. Yeah, the Republicans wanted only votes received by Election Day to be counted, but the split means the lower court's ruling stands, which allows them up to 3 days afterwards. But yeah, that's good news for voters.
Yep, good stuff. Amy Coney Barrett's nomination, who, of course, she's the nominee for the Supreme Court and will probably be a Supreme Court judge very soon. Her nomination was forced through the committee for a Senate floor vote that will be happening next week.
Yep. That was with no Democrats appearing?
Yeah, they all boycotted the thing, which unfortunately didn't really amount to much.
Yeah, well, there's a rule for the committee that they need to have at least two of the minority group with nobody showing up. Lindsey Graham just said, ah, fuck that rule, and went ahead and voted, you know, which shows what they're willing to go through.
Yeah.
To
the idea of having like a majority conservative Supreme Court has been a long time project for the Republicans for well over 20 years now. And now that they're at the point where it looks like they're just about to accomplish that, they really don't care what they have to do it.
Yep.
Yeah.
And Chuck Schumer did his thing saying Democrats will not lend a single ounce of legitimacy to the sham vote in the Judiciary Committee. They should have really done that in the hearings. No thanks to Dianne Feinstein.
Yeah.
We are voting with our feet, we're standing together, and we are standing against this unprecedented mad rush to jam through a Supreme Court nomination just days before an election. I think all told, the fastest that a nominee's ever been approved was 70 days. And I think by the time that that's the normal, that's the average, 70 days. They're looking to get Barrett in about 30 if she's confirmed on Monday. So that's barely even a month.
Yeah.
Pretty ridiculous.
Yeah, it is.
And even if Trump loses, don't, you know, rely on the idea of a lame duck session.
No. The time between the election and when his term officially ends is going to be when they are going to be at their most dangerous, because they will literally have nothing to lose at that point.
Yep.
So he's going to try and cause as much damage going out.
Especially if they're going to lose the Senate majority too.
Yeah. Which looks like that might actually happen.
Yep.
Anyway, obviously you can't talk about the election without Trump himself. Basically, Trump did a 60 Minutes interview that he ended up throwing a fit over because, you know, he actually had to go up against someone who wasn't in his bubble. So in order to try and make it look like, no, they just edited it to make it look bad, he posts the entire unedited video and it doesn't make him look any better.
No.
If especially anything, early makes on. Him worse.
Yeah, especially at the beginning where she's like, oh, you're ready to answer questions? Like, yeah, if they're fair. She's like, are you ready to answer tough questions? She's like, no, I'm not. It's like, you're not? It's like, no, I'm not.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, shit, jackass. Sometimes you have to do it.
It was Leslie Stahl that did this interview.
Mm-hmm.
Said, but you're okay with some tough questions. No, I'm not, Trump replied. From there, Trump spent much of the interview accusing Stahl of being biased and negative with their questioning. You can find the full thing on YouTube if you want to watch it.
Yeah.
He just bitches most of the time.
Pretty much.
That's what he is. Then there was a point where Somebody off camera mentions that there's about 5 more minutes to go for this interview.
Mm-hmm.
And he just says, well, I think we have enough. I think we have enough of an interview here. Okay, that's enough. Let's go. Let's go. Mm-hmm. Just leaves before it's finished. And then Pence comes over and does his bit.
Mm-hmm. And then there was that like big prop that they were supposed to use. Was like, these are all the healthcare accomplishments he's had. And it was in the form of this like enormous like 1,200 or 2,000 something.
Oh my God. Prop.
And then she actually peeked under it and it was all blank pages.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's like
when he had the big,
a movie
big
prop.
Table full of paper. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, here's the Obamacare. And here's our healthcare proposal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, oh, it's, you know, much less paper.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody looked at the paper and it's like, this is all blank.
Yeah.
It's all bullshit. And obviously it was, because he still keeps talking about his amazing healthcare plan.
Yeah.
That's, you know, weeks away. And it's like, what is it?
Yeah.
Where is it? Like, why aren't you trying to do this?
Can you tell us? Give us any clue, any indication what's going to be in it? No. He doesn't have one.
This is his last big chance to advertise for why he should get reelected as president. He did nothing.
Yeah. I want to remind everyone over the next few weeks, if you hear a story about how Melania and Baron are apparently quote unquote vacationing in Europe, get ready, because that means he's getting ready to flee the country and probably go to Russia to seek asylum.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether or not he's competent enough to actually pull that off is another story. But,
stop him from trying.
Mm-hmm. So, keep that on the back burner. Keep that in your mind. Because it's a possibility. Moving on from there, the director of national intelligence claims that Iran, or I guess somewhere in Iran's government, were behind sending these threatening Proud Boy emails to people in Arkansas and Florida.
Alaska and Florida.
Alaska, sorry. Arkansas would be AS, wasn't it? Yeah, it's Alaska and Florida. I don't know why.
Yeah, I think it's because your registration for voter stuff is kind of public.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how much information is public, but at least people there are exposed more than in other states. So this was something that was exploited. Mm-hmm. For these weird emails that I don't know if they have a copy of it here. I don't think so, but it was basically saying, like, we know you're registered as a Democrat in Florida, and like includes their email and their address.
Mm-hmm.
In the email, and says like, you need to change your email to, you know, such and such, to Republican. You change your party affiliation to Republican so that we know
mm-hmm.
that you're responding to us and vote for Trump.
Yeah. I can understand wanting to send like that to Florida, because Florida's election shenanigans are legendary the world over.
Yeah.
But why Alaska? Like, was that just a random thing to like throw off the scent or something?
I think it's maybe just because their information is public.
In
that same way that like Florida is, so. But it's not a big state that's going to affect much. Especially their stuff comes in so late compared to everything else. It's not.
Mm-hmm.
It's not one that ranks high on battleground states.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of random, I guess, but yeah. Now, question is Iran actually behind this?
Well, them and Russia are ones that are involved in a lot of stuff that's going on, so
yeah,
it's possible, but
it's very,
I don't think he would have any reason to lie about this.
I guess. All right. Next up, and this one is just really fucking stupid. House Republicans are complaining about Biden's use of Amtrak trains for campaigning.
Yeah. It's been one of his primary ways of getting around for his campaign stops.
Yeah, it's he's like one of Amtrak's biggest like supporters. So
yeah,
yeah,
and they're a taxpayer funded service.
Mm-hmm.
So you know he's partially paid for it.
Yep.
But I think they also hire them.
Mm-hmm.
But the there are four lawmakers in the House, led by Rep. Rick Crawford of Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
Asking Amtrak whether Biden drained taxpayer resources when he used a taxpayer-funded service to campaign, including featuring Amtrak trains in a campaign ad and chartering a train for his Build Back Better Express tour through Pennsylvania and Ohio after the first presidential debates.
Mm-hmm.
They demanded information about Biden's use of Amtrak trains, including how much Biden's campaign paid to charter the train, if the charter train disrupted any of Amtrak's services.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and let's see. Joe Biden, on his account, tweeted the Build Back Better Express tour was more about more than my love for trains. It was about meeting folks along the way, discussing how we can make their lives better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it just seems like just finding anything at this point to try and create a controversy.
Because that Hunter Biden thing is not taking off like they thought it would. So now they're basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now they're basically at DEFCON 1 now.
Yeah, the Biden campaign.
The desperation has really set in at this point.
Yeah, the Biden campaign's deputy national press secretary told the Philadelphia Inquirer, anyone can charter a train with Amtrak. Last time we checked, no one can charter the White House South Lawn for a political convention. Instead of wasting time on political stunts, congressional Republicans should stop ignoring Donald Trump's blatant abuses of taxpayer money and government resources. Which, hey, if they're concerned about wasting taxpayer money, that's probably the way to go.
Mm-hmm.
Versus the dude that is not the president.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, cool. One of the guys on this is my rep, my House rep, Bob Gibbs, Ohio. Yeah. So he can go fuck himself. Yeah. I voted against him.
Yeah. Is he up for re-election this year?
I think so. Yeah. If he wasn't, oh well. I vote against Republicans every chance I could.
Yeah, gotcha. let's see, what else? Oh, yeah. So one of the things that Trump has been doing basically for the all 4 years of his tenure is that trying to turn China into the big boogeyman that's going to destroy us all. Starting a trade war with them. All those tariffs that do nothing but raise the rate, just send off the expenses to the average buyer, you know. Guess who also, it turns out, has a bank account in China under their corporate name?
That came up in the debate.
Yeah, and actually it's not really even a surprise. I mean, people have been talking about this probably since 2015.
Yeah.
That and all throughout it, that yeah, he's got a lot of business interests in China, and you know it's not a surprise, but apparently now everyone's actually paying attention to it. I guess
on these tax returns also make it more obvious.
Yeah, he's actually paid more taxes in China than he has in the United States.
Yeah, it's under the name of Trump International Hotels Management, LLC.
Mm-hmm.
Shows he's paid $188,561 in taxes in China from 23 to 2015 while pursuing licensing deals.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's even to the degree that I think people in China on their social media have been making fun of him paying nothing in the U.S. but paying a bunch of taxes in China.
Nice.
Oh, yeah.
Nice.
I think even having pictures of him in like Chinese communist outfits.
Yeah. Like having him wearing like the Mao suit and everything. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanking him for the support.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, the folks over in China, they watch American politics like a hawk, and they can be just as snarky.
Yeah.
Believe me. Finally. Because we kind of mentioned it earlier, but in the news newest Borat movie, Rudy Giuliani is found in a compromising position with Borat's quote-unquote underage daughter. She's not actually underage. The actress is like 24, but...
She's also not his daughter, right?
Right.
Yeah.
She's just an actress.
But this is Borat's daughter.
Yeah, she's like supposed to be like 15 in the movie.
Yeah.
And there is no way to...
There's no way he comes out of it looking good.
No. Like, the absolute best case scenario is that he was looking to hook up with a girl who was much, 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 much younger than he was, and he not his wife.
Yeah. Which then he tweeted in response to this saying, the Borat video is a complete fabrication. Which, no, it's not.
Nope.
I was tucking in my shirt after taking off the recording equipment. The time before, during, or after the interview, was I ever inappropriate? Sacha Baron Cohen implies otherwise. He is a stone cold liar.
Dude, you were laying back on the bed like you were about to get some.
Mm-hmm. From what I've read, he was actually nice about it, not going in super hard on it.
Yeah.
Not trying to make it more obvious or slanted or whatever.
Yeah.
Weird.
But also, this is a guy that whose first wife is related to him.
Yep.
His cousin. Oh, God, they made cracks about that.
Yep. Second cousin.
Yep.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's it for 2020 U.S. Election Watch. Our final installment of this will probably be next week. After that, it will be the fallout. We'll call it the 2020 U.S. fallout.
Yeah.
Because holy shit, there is definitely going to be some, probably fairly explosive. So stay tuned. So, moving on from there, we got some more political news. The Justice Department indicted 6 Russian hackers for a spree of hacks that they committed. Fairly recently, I think, wasn't it?
Their most famous ones involved the 2018 Olympics and the 2017 French election.
Yeah.
As part of the 4-year-long hacking spree. Yeah. It's good that we're finally doing something about some of these people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, these are part of the Russian intelligence agency.
Mm-hmm.
Too, so.
Yeah, these are like
not
the...
just randoms.
Yeah, these guys actually work with the Russian government.
Yep.
This is like, you know, the Tencent army over in China. but yeah. So again, as people will say, yes, Russia is trying to meddle in our election.
I think there's reports that 2 states have been compromised to some degree. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Not sure about details on that stuff, but yeah.
Yeah.
It's too bad nobody wanted to reinforce any of that stuff, make it our elections a bit more secure.
Yeah. But by the way, speaking of elections, we don't have it in the show notes, but we might as well bring it up. Bolivia. Bolivia, those of you guys remember, that was originally Evo Morales was head of that country, and then he was ousted in a far-right military coup. Yeah, they had an election this week, and his party ended up winning overwhelmingly against the center-right sort of junta party. That's the one that... that people suspect Elon Musk had something to do with because of all the lithium that Bolivia has. So yeah, that also happened.
Okay.
It's a big event, big deal. Awesome deal. And now, big story coming out from the Justice Department. The Justice Department and 11 other states have filed an antitrust suit against Google. And honestly, it's about goddamn time.
Yeah, though, can you guess... what party the state's AGs are from?
The Republicans.
Yep. There are others interested in like blue states, but they're still working on their investigation into this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's Let's see. Critics contend that the multi-billion-dollar fines and mandated changes in Google's practices imposed by European regulators in recent years have not been severe enough against their search business. And Google needs to be broken up to change its conduct. Justice Department didn't lay out specific remedies along those lines, although it asked the court to order structural relief as needed to remedy any anti-competitive harm. So that opens the door to possible fundamental changes, such as spin off the company's Chrome browser. Google vowed to defend itself and respond immediately via tweets. Quote, today's lawsuit by the Department of Justice is deeply flawed. Google because they choose to, not because they're forced to or because they can't find alternatives. But I think it's also partly references that Google is the default search engine on phone browsers.
Yeah.
Oftentimes.
Mm-hmm.
Which kind of makes sense for like Android stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There's probably something that needs to be like a prompt when you start using any of that stuff. Like, which one do you want to use?
Exactly.
Now, do you want to use Google? That opens up all the other parts of the offerings and all that, but also doesn't help. There's not really that many good alternatives.
Yeah.
There's Bing, which whenever
it's
I do
owned
like
by
the,
Microsoft now.
Yeah.
So.
But whenever I do their rewards stuff, it's like, oh, you got to search my times. I just pull up some of the tabs that are reopened from some of the other things you're doing for the reward stuff and just see how quickly I can get to porn. It's a lot easier than Google does.
Yep. So that's the last sort of serious story we've got for the week. We'll move on to the science stuff. First off, there was a big-ass murder hornet nest that was discovered in Washington State.
Oop. Yeah. We talked about that a few weeks ago. They discovered murder hornets in Washington. They've been working since then to try and figure out a way to track them back to the nest.
Yep.
Things like using dental floss and trackers to attach to them. Some managed to chew them off. Others didn't stick. Stuff like that, but they finally got some that actually went back to the nest. And the second link here shows people actually working on
vacuuming
this nest.
Yeah, it's
some sci-fi shit.
Oh,
the
yeah.
Images. Yeah, they have these big foam suits that are very thick to protect them from the
stings
and all that kind of stuff. And I saw an image of the stinger that these things have. It's like 6 millimeters.
Yeah.
Which is like a good, it could get like halfway into your finger if it stung you there. Yeah, which is like, Jesus Christ. That's fucked. But yeah, it's a basketball sized nest. It's the city of Blaine near the Canadian border. It's estimated to contain about 100 to 200 hornets. Which is a shitload of them.
Oh, yeah.
They're literally, like, wrapping around this tree.
Yep.
Like, plastic wrap. As they're then, like, trying to suck them out with their specialized vacuums.
Yeah. Now, keep in mind, like, seeing, like, giant hornet nests are not necessarily something that's unheard of. But these are murder hornets we're talking about.
Yeah, these things can go into nests that are like 10,000 bees and just kill them all.
Yep.
From what I saw, the Japanese bees have kind of started developing defenses where they essentially swarm around the hornet.
And suffocate it.
Not suffocate it. They kind of flap their wings as much as possible and kind of like overheat it to kill
it.
It's kind of a weird thing. But yeah, obviously bees over here have not had much interactions with these things to even start developing those kind of defenses.
Yeah. So that's kind of a kind of an issue.
That's why these agriculture departments in Washington are very much trying to keep them at bay as much as they can.
Yeah.
Trying to eliminate them completely if they can.
Yeah. And fortunately, it looks like they are pretty on top of it.
Yeah.
So, because, you know, apparently these things have not managed to, even though they've hit the West Coast, they apparently haven't really managed to spread that far.
Yeah. It's pretty much like that. They're like Pacific Northwest, Canada area. Mm-hmm. Southwest Canada.
Yeah. There's a look at those pictures and stuff I got there. It is it is both very uncomfortable and also kind of neat. So, so we got a couple of stories out of NASA. First one, a spacecraft from NASA actually bumped into an asteroid to collect some samples.
Yeah, this was the OSIRIS-REx spacecraft.
Mm-hmm.
That was going to collect debris from an asteroid and essentially kind of just tapped it to kind of set samples towards it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they have a video here, but they did put out a video of it like slowly approaching it and that is bumping into it.
Mm-hmm.
To kind of send this these rocks and dust into the into space towards it. I think they're trying to essentially right now see how much they got out of it.
Yeah.
And if they need more, they can do it again. Right now, I think it said somewhere here. Yeah, right now it's about 50 miles away from it. This mm-hmm. asteroid called Bennu, BENNU. It took a few hours to get the pictures back from it. Even almost hit the target they wanted almost perfectly. It was about a yard away from it. So that's a pretty cool thing they're doing.
Right.
Yeah, if they figure out they've got less than 2 ounces of samples collected, they have to decide by the 30th whether to try again.
Mm-hmm.
Which would not occur until about January.
Yeah. All right. And we got another NASA story here. In further news that people really are starting to take the idea of colonizing the moon seriously, NASA taps Nokia to build a 4G cell network on the moon.
Yeah. A weird thing, but I think they're essentially like trying to create like a moon base that would be used as like a stepstone to go to Mars.
Yeah.
Where you could take supplies to set up for further travel to Mars.
Mm-hmm. Sounds pretty good to me.
But yeah, they got a $370 million contract. This is a $370 million, 14 companies provide technology for the Artemis moon landing program.
Mm-hmm.
Not sure how much Nokia's getting about it.
Mm.
But I guess their Nokia Bell Labs division will build a 4G communication system to be deployed on a lunar lander of the moon surface in late 2022.
Hmm. Alrighty then.
Should at least help out with communications there.
Oh, yeah.
Besides just typical radio stuff.
Yep. All righty. Moving on from there. And now in the entertainment news, John Oliver, the famous host of Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, he finally managed to get a sewage plant in Dansbury, Connecticut named after him.
Yeah. he had a bit on this on his recent show.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about this, particularly like watching the Zoom meeting of the city council, and the first guy kind of being annoyed about it and voting no, but pretty much everybody else voted for it. Because along with just giving him the name for this, he's also donating to a couple charities in town. So it's kind of a win-win either way.
Mm-hmm.
And he wore a homemade protective suit. That's just him with like a big plastic bubble around his top half of his body. And like kitchen gloves, looks like, on his hands to receive it. He said, "This place takes the worst that humanity can produce, transformed into something that we can live with. And now more than ever, there's something inspirational in that, because at the end of this awful, awful year, what could be more important than evidence that if we want to, we can come together, overcome our differences, and sort our shit out."
Mm-hmm. All right. And now for a bit of unfortunate news. Jeff Bridges announced this week that he has lymphoma.
Yeah. At least good for him, as he's obviously well off enough he can afford the care.
Yeah.
For this, and it seems like they got it early enough that he should be okay, but he tweeted this out saying, as the dude would say, new shit has come to light. I've been diagnosed with lymphoma, although it is a serious disease. I feel fortunate that I have a great team of doctors and the prognosis is good. Starting treatment will keep you posted on my recovery. And then second tweet, thanking everybody that's sent love and support his way. He said, "While I have you, please remember to go vote, because we are all in this together."
Yep. So, yeah. Good luck to him.
Yeah.
And now, some other news that, let's be honest, a lot of us saw coming. Quibi will cease service after 6 months of launch.
Yep. It's going to be shutting down about
December 1st. Seriously, did not see that coming.
Yeah. I knew this thing wouldn't do well because I kept seeing ads last year for it. You know, I never heard of it. I was like, what the hell is this? And it didn't even launch until the following year.
Yep.
Seemed weirdly premature for a service that didn't exist. But it was like a video streaming service built around phones. And that's like, you know, the way that you can watch YouTube or whatever. It's all was it portrait mode? Like your phone, holding your phone up. So not, you know, widescreen like most shows are made today. I don't know if there's been any like quality content made on it. I know there's like a clip of a show about a woman that has a golden arm, and she's dying because the gold is infesting her system. But she refuses to get rid of it because it's a golden arm. Which I've seen people be like, this is emblematic of Quibi as a whole. Something that has, it's very costly, there's a lot of money, but serves no purpose. It's just killing itself. And they've been kind of one of those media companies just handing out checks left and right to get people working on its platform. Nobody's really tuned in on any of it. They had like $1.7 billion in funding and have fucked it all up on something nobody really wanted. It should have just been like a high quality YouTube channel. Like at the end of the day, that's kind of the level of content they were making.
Like that, yeah.
But yeah, it's, it seems like it, I don't know what the chances are any of that stuff maybe finds new homes. But I don't know if any of it deserves it, but some of it's probably watchable if nobody watched it.
Yeah,
but I don't. I wonder what how the formatting works to transfer it over to every other platform that doesn't force it in portrait mode.
It's just weird.
Yeah. Anyway. And now here's something that I guess a lot of people didn't see coming. So George Lucas, pretty much everybody remembers him for being the guy behind Star Wars. He also had a little bit of a hand in the, creation of the Indiana Jones franchise as well.
Yeah, he did.
But what a lot of people don't realize is that, you know, as far as like making movies, George Lucas has had some other, films that he's made over the years too. Famously, he became famous for the I think it was the early 70s movie American Graffiti, which was essentially the movie that got enough box office success that he was able to convince the studio to let him make Star Wars. But he's made a bunch of other movies too. He famously made, I think it was THX 1138, I think is what it's called, which was a dystopian movie based on like a student film he made back in the 60s.
Yeah, there's droids that are THX 1138, and there's references to it in Star Wars.
Yeah. He also was the producer of that movie Red Tails that came out a couple years ago. He also famously was behind this awful fucking 3D animated jukebox musical called Epic. The one of the movies he made that was, I think a lot of people were at least he was expecting it to become like another franchise, is a movie called Willow. Which, if you've never seen it before, it's not a bad movie. It's definitely kind of Tolkien inspired. But it's not a bad movie. It also inspired a fairly famous Nintendo tie-in game that was very Zelda-like in its creation, and also famous for its very English dialogue. What a lot of people don't know is Willow actually also did technically get a expansion or sequels of sorts. There was a series of books that were released back in the 90s that were meant to be sort of extend the story. It was co-written between George Lucas and Chris Claremont of X-Men fame.
Mm-hmm.
And this week, Disney Plus announced that they're making a sequel series.
Yep.
Really?
Yep.
Yeah. That's the thing I didn't know, is Ron Howard directed the original movie.
Yep.
But yeah, he is involved in this as executive producer.
Mm-hmm.
Warwick Davis is returning to play his titular role.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, John M. Chu of Crazy Rich Asians and In the Heights is directing this, at least the pilot, and executive produce. Jonathan Kasdan and Wendy Miracle are working on this as showrunners.
Mm-hmm.
Kasdan of Solo and Wendy of Arrow fame.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's going to follow. So you introduce all new characters. What else? I was just talking about the original. Yeah, so they're going to be doing something new. Warwick Davis is going to reprise his role.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be surprised if his son also is involved at some point. Because, when they had, I think in the most recent movie, Rise of Skywalker, he played his Ewok character, and his son played the son of that character. So he reprised his role and did all that. So he seems interested in getting his son involved in all that kind of stuff, too.
Mm-hmm. All right. And finally, last story for the night, Netflix is making more deals with anime studios in Japan and South Korea. So look forward to more Netflix anime originals.
Yep. They signed new content deals with 3 Japanese animation houses and 1 from Korea, making about 9 total they have there.
Yep.
Let's see, Anima and Company is one of them, Science Saru in MAPPA, and Studio Mir in Korea. The previous deals they had happened in 2018, added some more in 2019. Yeah, you know, shows like Altered Carbon Resleeved, which is from Anima, Ghost in the Shell, SAC 2045 from Production IG.
Mm-hmm.
Dragon's Dogma from Sublimation. Currently the pipeline are Spriggan from David Production. Vampire in the Garden, Wit Studio, which is part of Production IG. And Super Crooks, which is Bones. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm not sure what they're working on here, but seems like it should be a good injection of new talent.
Yeah. I am familiar with Spriggan. That was a That was a fairly popular manga in the late 80s, early 90s that was the inspiration for a movie. I forget what it's called. I'm trying to remember what the name of the movie was. I think it's just called Spriggan. Yeah. Basically, like, it's about this, like, it's like, takes place like during the last years of the Cold War. There's this, this kid of like high school age who is part of an organization that goes around and tries to find what they call out of place artifacts. Which are essentially like, usually they're like artifacts that are references to like famous, like, mythical pieces like Noah's Ark or the Lance of Longinus. But usually these are all connected to like some old ancient civilization that used to be on Earth at some point. It's pretty awesome. Yeah.
So they mentioned here Studio Mirror would be the most prolific of these.
Mm-hmm.
Because they worked on Legend of Korra,
mm-hmm.
Voltron Legendary Defender, and The Witcher Nightmare of the Wolf.
Yep.
So they'll be working on more stuff for Netflix.
Mm-hmm. Alrighty then. Sounds good. All right. I do believe that is the show we've got for tonight. Yes, we do. All right. So I would like to remind all of our listeners, if you've got a question, comment, something you want us to read on the air, you can get in contact with us at letsweekenders@gmail.com. That's letsweekenders@gmail.com. We've got links for you in the show notes. Also, you can catch our little bit of unscripted shenanigans on Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Google Play, RSS, archive.org, or any kind of podcast aggregator you can think of. And if we're not there, well, just wait a few minutes. We will be eventually. So, with that, I have been your host with the most, Brandon Perkins. Join us next week for a fresh new show. And for Chris Elogian, Teresa Sammons, I'd like to say good night, sleep tight, and remember, and as we will remind you, until then, remember to vote in November.